after having this last week, to being having a long cold. It was a pretty strong one. I had slight fever most of the time, and bad headaches, and weakness. There's a poem in here, so at some point I may want to read it. At the Bellina sitting last Saturday, I started with a Rumi poem. And I'm going to start with that poem again tonight. I think it's going to be a very different talk. Some similar themes, but I've been thinking about the poem more deeply and have different approach, I think, to the similar points that I brought up last Saturday. And the poem I've known for a long, long time, and there's something unique about the poem. A lot of Rumi's poems are ecstatic about the wonders of the beloved and the wonders of love. And one poem he talks about love is not, this is a paraphrase of a different poem, crude paraphrase. It says something like, love is not a wonderful fairy tale. He doesn't say that, but something like that. It is a desolation. And he says something about falling, and in falling, finding wings. And so, there's desolation in love, but embracing the desolation, we sprout wings and fly. So sometimes his poems have that quality of being in relationship with the beloved is not all roses and a nice cappuccino in the morning when the larks are singing. Sometimes it has some rigorous harshness to it. His poems do, some of his poems do refer to that aspect of our human journey. But this other poem, it's really, this poem I'm about to recite, there's something really cut to the chase about it. And the first line is, today, like every day, we wake up empty and scared. So that's the first line. Say, boom! today, like every day, once again, we wake up empty and scared. And I think on some level, to a greater or lesser degree, there's some truth to that. Joko Beck in her book says that if I were to approach just about anybody and scratch a little bit below the surface, 9 times out of 10 I'd find fear running amok, with what she says. And I think that's the sentiment of that first line. Life is not safe. Life is not safe. None of us are going to get out alive. No. And I had fleeting thoughts of my own mortality while I was sick this week. I'm 56 now. People my age sometimes drop dead. I don't want to. But it happens. And I've practiced for a couple of decades, and I was thinking about this. I've been reflecting on mortality, and at some point, what's growing in me, and the sickness kind of like brought episodes of this up, is, we all, at a certain age, we become conceptually cognizant of mortality. Intellectually, we know that, we don't live forever, but the actual bodily realization of it, where we defer from. we don't, but at some point, you know, 56, you know, floaters in the eye, a visceral awareness starts to arise. Yeah. And it's no, and you, it's kind of like you can't avert from it anymore. And with 2 decades of practice, I am not totally freaked out by that. I've made some peace with that, but it's not, but I can't say that I'm looking forward to it. You know, it's, that undiscovered country does, is provocative of some measure of anxiety. Life is not safe. The events shortly before Christmas in Connecticut, another indication, life is not safe. The pressures of this life, the furnace of this life, cause some of our, some souls to fry, and in their torment, they inflict horrors upon others. And we haven't figured that out yet to heal as a species well enough to where that doesn't happen. In fact, it seems that particular symptom of our malaise seems to be getting a bit worse as the years go on. The fracture between normalcy and total freak out to such an extent that one wants to make an impact upon it with their exit, you know. Well, you know what I'm saying? You know, that is in our culture. That is part of our life. It makes us feel unsafe. Today, like every day, we wake up in this world with its traumas and its uncertainties and its pains. I think that's the first line. Today, like every other day, we wake up, and part of us may have some despair. If we're conscious, there's probably part of us that is not a stranger to despair, I think, you know. We wouldn't be fully human if we were not susceptible to the despair that is in this world. Because to be human is to vibrate with all sentient beings on some level or another. And there are sentient beings that are in deep despair. And if we know love, we partake of that. So we wake up empty and scared not because we're bad people. We wake up empty and scared not because we're not enlightened yet. We wake up empty and scared because we wake up in this world. Now the second line offers hope, offers a foundation for faith, is how I read it. So the first line is, today, like every other day, we wake up empty and scared. The second line is, don't open the door to the study, take down the musical instrument. And then the final line, which is a summation of what the point of the second line is, let the beauty you love be what you do. So that's a very short quote. One of its shortest. Today, like every other day, we wake up empty and scared. Don't open the door to the study. Take down a musical instrument. Let the beauty you love be what you do. So, what tends to happen when tragic, traumatizing, or horrific events occur? A plethora of commentary, of interpretation, of trying to ferret out the reasons why. And my experience of watching the news or listening to the radio after events such as this is that it just tends to perpetuate the anxiety. tends to perpetuate the empty and scared feeling. It doesn't offer any solace or any comfort. This, you know, looking at it from various angles, you know, it's all about gun control. It's all about more safety in the schools. All teachers should be armed. And all this ratiocinations about the event do not help, it seems to me. And so in theology, there's this a part of theology called theodicy. And I kind of like the fact that the word theodicy and the word idiocy have a sonorous characteristic to them, because theodicy is the attempt to explain, classically, if God is all-loving, all-good, and all-powerful, why is there evil in the world? Why is there pain and suffering? Why do the innocent suffer? And why do the unrighteous prosper? You know, that whole thing. And theologians, you know, try to reason out and create various theological explanations for this. You know, the doctrine of original sin is one classical ancient theodicy. Well, in the garden, Eve tempted Adam with an apple, and they turned their backs on God and all of that. So, and there's consequences for that. And that mythology is replaced by more subtle attempts to reason out why there's pain, why there's suffering, why there's malice and hatred. If God is all good and his creation, her creation is all good, etc., how could this be? That's theodicy. And so when I hear the first line, or the beginning of the second line to Rumi's poem, every day, today, like every day, we wake up empty and scared. Don't open the door to the study. Don't try to figure shit. I work with people who have a colorful vocabulary. Don't try to figure shit out. You know, that's not going to do you any good. You know, philosophy is not going to comfort the distress you feel in your heart. Take out a musical instrument. Let the beauty you love be what you do. And what's happening with that? What's happening with that? I've been thinking about music a lot, and you know, I volunteered to play guitar Christmas Eve, and I played at the potluck, the hot pot, and I played. And you heard me play better than you ever heard me play before. I know that. You don't have to. You know, I just felt it in my gut. I don't have to hear you say so. But if you want to, you can.
You play better than you ever did before.
Yeah. And so I've been playing a lot. And I'm playing even better now than I was then. I'm really impressed with myself. And I've been thinking about music. And the thing that I find interesting is music and art, the power of it is entirely subjective. You know, what is music? Well, on a phenomenological level, it's variations in air pressure hitting the eardrum. You know, there's air is moving at 440 beats a second, and then some more air is going at 220 beats a second. You hear an octave, but it's just vibrations of air. But we're not experiencing vibrations of air, we're experiencing beauty. And that's something very subjective. It's not reducible to the phenomenological phenomena. That's a redundancy. To the phenomena. It's not reducible to the physical. It's something that's happening subjectively, within our subjectivity. And yet, when we're really attuned to the experience of beauty and art, we're outside of ourselves. We lose our individual orientation, you know, and we disappear into the music. So it's simultaneously subjective, and it seems to obliterate the subject. It's very fascinating to me, you know, that to really do music properly or well or in a consummate way, the self disappears, and it's just the music. And yet at the same time, it's a purely sub, the beauty, the aesthetic experience is a purely subjective experience. It has triggers from variations in air pressure, but the apprehension of beauty is not apprehension of vibrations or red and yellow and shapes. No, beauty is something subjective that is triggered by the objective. It's a subjective experience that is selfless, and that is really intriguing to me. And it's utterly useless. Utterly useless. What is art? What is music? And I feel like it's a celebration of consciousness. Wow. I'm conscious. And then just celebrating the fact that there's hearing in this world, celebrating the fact that there's sound or vision, feeling in this world, and creating a way to actually celebrate that, honor that. And in doing so, there's wonder. Music is a constant source of wonder to me, how, you know, simple variations in air pressure can evoke such strong feeling. And one piece of music that perpetually blows my mind is Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings. Does anybody know that here? And why I find it so fascinating, because the melody is so ridiculously simple. You know, it's really like very simple stepwise scales, you know, that goes down a little bit, then back up. Not a whole lot of intricate rhythm. And yet it has been called the saddest piece of music ever written. It was played for various people's funerals. I don't know if it was John F. Kennedy, but no. You can Google it. Wikipedia will tell you how many notable figures had this music played at their funerals, because it's such powerfully moving music, and it's simple. And it's just a simple stepwise motion. And so music for me is provocative of deep wonder. And I think in this poem, Rumi is suggesting that waking up in this world, empty and scared, because it's this world with, you know, with the various unknowns and the various lack of safety and the uncertainties, we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I'm pretty sure that there's not going to be a meteor crash into the earth, because our technology would have told us by now, but we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And we know we don't know. And the longer we're alive, the more certain we are that life is uncertain. But each moment of consciousness is an infinitely precious jewel. And Rumi, I think, is suggesting that is our salvation. Recognizing that, seeing that, celebrating that will give us some resiliency to persevere as a human and stay human in this world. And that's our task. This world is provocative of a lot of things that would prompt one to shut down the heart. Feel that, you know, there's great danger in succumbing to the temptation to shut down the heart, to build safe walls of rationalizations between ourselves and the horrors that are visited upon us as a people with some unfortunate frequency. And the consequence is we become a little less than human. and create space for more horrors by our lack of allowing our hearts to vibrate in sympathy with the pain of the world. So our task is to stay human enough so that our hearts can vibrate in sympathy with the pain of the world. That is the practice of Avalokiteshvara, which is eyes that regard sentient beings, that hear suffering. Here's the cries of the world, as I was just put. And that is our task, to stay human. We can't stay human if we succumb to despair. We go slightly or greatly mad. So we need our salvation. We need to not succumb to the temptation to go slightly mad by building fanciful rationalizations. We need to savor the preciousness of consciousness, which can restore faith that no matter what, life is good. No matter what, a moment of consciousness is an incredibly gratuitous gift of infinite value, infinite beauty, infinite preciousness that's just bestowed upon us moment after moment after moment after moment. And deeply savoring how precious being conscious is can give us the resiliency to stay awake, stay human in this world. So I mentioned in Bolinas that one of my early practice periods outside in Tassajara, outside of the Zendo, a quote from Dogen was placed on the wall on the outside of the Zendo about practice period. Versus, you know, something to the effect like, we enter practice period in order to deepen and widen our faith. That was the statement. That's a fairly close reconstruction of it. We enter into practice period in order to deepen and widen our faith. And faith in Zen is an interesting thing. It's not faith in an external God. There's no object of faith. No. We don't worship Brahms Buddhas. A facile answer could be, well, we have faith in our own Buddha nature. Well, yeah, what does that mean? You hear those kinds of words all the time. What does that mean? The experience of practice period is a rather austere experience. And I should have looked up that Walden quote. Where Thoreau says, I entered the woods in order to do something, to face life directly on its own terms, to weed out or to ferret out or to get rid of anything that was not life, and to face life in the wrong. And I'm paraphrasing badly. And if life were mean, then to embrace the whole meanness of it, to just strip away everything that was not just the raw, direct experience of being alive. And practice period, one way of looking at practice period is it's a hothouse for doing just that. A rigorous schedule of just sitting, simple food, little sleep, little opportunities for diversion. People are encouraged not to play musical instruments, ironically, encouraged not to, on days off, it's to say, well, okay, you can read the newspaper, see what the world's doing. It's not that kind of, but it's, and there's no prohibition about reading romance novels or other things. but there's an encouragement to consider not doing so, or if you must, to limit that kind of recreation for the 4 or 9 days. Relaxed schedule, going for walks is good. But basically, just practice, just sit, just eat, just do the practice. And in this context of stripping things away, the simple experience of being alive can be quite moving. Just seeing the steam rising from one soup in the morning. Can be provocative of tears. The jewel-like quality of being alive in the moment, like I say, practice period, one way of looking at it is that it's a laboratory where conditions are set up to create the potential for a person to experience the jewel-like quality of a moment of consciousness. The sound of a dog barking can be wow, because there's so little else going on. And so that's my sense of what Dogen, my experience of practice period, of how it deepens faith, is it strips superficialities away, it strips distractions away, and you have no choice but just to sit and live and experience what it's like to be alive in the moment. And sometimes when the monkey mind is run amok, when various issues or concerns or pains are arising, then just living can be hard, painful. But almost inevitably, there's some little break from that, some little fissure, some little, you know, between one thought and another thought, there's a little bit of space, and you hear this blue jay, and it just penetrates all the way through. That, you know, and Suzuki Roshi said something like that, that the blue jay will enter your heart. And I had that experience. And I was, especially in the very beginning, I was quite susceptible to those experiences of bliss, of wonder. And so practice period is like, One metaphor for it in Zen poetry is the stringless lute, or the stringless guitar. It's like, you know, you don't open the door to the study, take down the cosmos and play it in the watching of the steam rising from the soup, where, you know, the same kind of subjective, selfless wonder that arises in the apprehension of the beauty of art can be accessed through the apprehension of just being alive in the moment. That practice period creates the conditions that makes that a possibility. You can't will it, you can't compel it to happen, just like you can't really compel those peak aesthetic experiences in music. And if you discipline yourself well, technique-wise, and if you discipline yourself well psychologically to be open and available, they're more likely, but some days you just can't get it, you know, you can't control it, and you can't control these experiences in practice either. But that's the point. That's the ground of our faith, is that in spite of it all, we know that this life is a gift of immeasurable value and beauty. And in order to appreciate it, and in order to serve sentient beings, we need to keep our hearts open to the beauty and the grace and the gift of life. And in order to serve beings properly, well, we need to be open to the fear and the pain and the despair that is visited upon our human family all too often. Thank you. So, I'll read a poem. And this poem was given to me after the talk in Bolinas by Pam. And she brought it as a New Year's poem for me. And then I gave a talk somewhat similar to the one I just gave. And then Pam came up and gave me this poem by Jack Gilbert. And the title of this poem is A Brief for the Defense. I just got an email. Sorrow everywhere. Slaughter everywhere. If babies are not starving someplace, they are starving somewhere else, with flies in their nostrils. But we enjoy our lives because that's what God wants. Otherwise, the mornings before summer dawn would not be made so fine. The Bengal tiger would not be fashioned so miraculously well. The poor women at the fountain are laughing together between the suffering they have known and the awfulness in their future. Smiling and laughing while somebody in the village is very sick. There is laughter every day in the terrible streets of Calcutta. And the women laugh in the cages of Bombay. If we deny our happiness, resist our satisfaction, we lessen the importance of their deprivation. We must risk delight. We can do without pleasure, but not delight, not enjoyment. We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of this world. To make injustice the only measure of our attention is to praise the devil. So, quite interesting. I gave a talk like the one I gave tonight, and then Pam walks up and gives me this poem. Okay, well, we have 3 minutes left to hold up the placards scoring me between 0 and 10. Or to do something entirely different. Anything to say?
Beings are numberless. We vow to freedom. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to freedom. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to freedom. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it.